Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link. It's Monday, the 17th of October, 2017. I'm Wanjiku Mwaura.
And I am Abubakar Jalo. We are coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany.
In today's edition, leader of the pro-Biafran separatists, Nnamdi Kanu, failed to appear at a court hearing in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
No one knows where Nnamdi Kanu is, and this is almost a month now when he disappeared. The security agencies cannot find him.
And Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto says his Jubilee coalition government has nothing against the opposition demand to the Electoral Commission, the IEBC.
I was very categorical to the IEBC that we have absolutely no problem with IEBC agreeing with our competitors on any of the matters that our competitors have proposed as minimum or irreducible minimum demands.
Those stories and a lot more coming up shortly.
But first, let's hear what's been happening around the world.
I'm Shay Maniki with DW News. U.S.-backed militias have declared victory on Tuesday over an Islamic State militant stronghold in Syria's capital, Raqqa, where the extremists plan terror operations in Syria, Iraq, and around the world. A formal declaration of victory is to be announced soon after landmines are cleared and streets are made safe in Islamic State's once de facto capital. International aid groups say tens of thousands of people have fled the northern Syrian city, and many are in desperate need of aid. International communities have joined forces to offer aid for crisis-hit Somalia after a massive truck bomb blamed on al-Shabaab militants exploded on Saturday, killing nearly 300 people and injuring another 400, one of the deadliest attacks in Somalia's history. A U.S. military plane landed in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, with medical and humanitarian aid supplies, while Muhanga Kianja, a security officer with the African Union mission, told reporters they are still searching for survivors.
So many people have died. We have not yet established the number of the people that have died. All efforts are in place to make sure that we get the survivors from the rubble.
Opposition leader Raila Odinga has suspended protest against Kenya's election body after three people last week were shot dead, telling his supporters they would announce their next course of action on Friday when they would also honor the fallen. Odinga's withdrawal from a re-election against incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta has thrown Kenya into further political chaos and confusion, with East Africa's richest economy worsening amid the crisis. William Ruto, Kenya's deputy president, told reporters Odinga pulled out of the election scheduled for October 26 to avoid defeat.
We all know that Mr. Odinga does not want to participate in this election because he knows the results. We cannot force him to participate in an election.
This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. At least three people have died in violent clashes in Togo after an imam close to the opposition was arrested, further fueling calls for the end to the 50-year rule of the Gunasingbe family. The Pan-African National Party and 13 other parties have defied a government ban on midweek protests by calling for marches in capital Lomé on Wednesday and Thursday. South African President Jacob Zuma has sacked a vocal critic from his cabinet, dropping Higher Education Minister Blade Nzimande, a veteran member of the South African Communist Party, which is a key political ally within the ruling African National Congress alliance. The sacking is likely to deepen political rifts between the parties before the ANC chooses a new party leader in December, and as the ANC relies heavily on its coalition to garner support in elections. And now in sports, Leicester City have sacked manager Craig Shakespeare just 4 months after he took over the reins of the former Premier League champions. The Foxes are near the bottom in the Premier League and have not yet won a single game in their past six league matches. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
Welcome back. My name is Wanjiku Mwaura.
And I am Abubakar Jalo. If you are listening to us live on Facebook, thank you for being there. Leave us your comment on the page. We will get to them whenever we can.
And we start the show off in West Africa, where Nnamdi Kanu, the leader of the pro-Biafran group that wants to break away from Nigeria, failed to show up in court today. As his treason trial resumed, Kanu has not been seen for several weeks. His lawyer, Ifeanyi Ejiofor, told the Federal High Court in Abuja his client was in the custody of the federal government. Earlier, I spoke to Ben Shemang, and he started by explaining Nnamdi Kanu's whereabouts.
Right now, no one knows where Nnamdi Kanu is, and this is almost a month now when he disappeared. The security agencies cannot find him, and even his lawyer is now saying that, look, government should know where he is, when indeed others are saying that since he has been holding brief for his client, he has to also know where Nnamdi Kanu is.
And what reason did the government give for Kanu's absence?
Well, for the government, rather, it's worried that the court fixed a date for sitting. The lawyer did not bring him. Those who also stood in as guarantors for him to bring him to court are not bringing him.
Would these charges against him fuel more uproar and possible protests rather than contain them?
Well, the truth of the matter is, even today in court, some of his friends were busy protesting outside at the court and, of course, chanting some songs. But again, that does not preclude the fact that some legal issues will have to be handled. So whether people protest for or against, the law is just there to take its course.
And how are Nigerians reacting to the pro-Biafra leader's trial?
Some people of Eastern Nigeria, they feel that there are legitimate concerns. The region has been neglected. Some are saying that they don't have a fair share when it comes to appointments in government. But others are saying, look, in Nigeria, virtually everywhere you find marginalization is just not an Igbo matter alone.
So their concerns about marginalization is actually a government failure to deliver on its promises to the people.
Yes, even the government itself sometimes will say, yes, there's the need to do quite a lot of appointments when it comes to southeastern part of Nigeria, take construction work, either there are roads or some physical constructions there.
That was DW's Ben Shemang in Abuja.
And we have some couple of responses here. This one from Sunday Chukwa, who says the Nigerian military should be held responsible for Nnamdi Kanu's whereabouts. Why must you raid someone's house who have a court case?
Very, very many interesting comments that are coming in on several stories. And Carlo Gambino says, I think that Nnamdi Kanu should be convicted in absentia.
Well, I think we have a response to that. We will get to it at some point. But for now, Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto has spoken to the media about the ongoing political rift between the Election Commission, the IEBC, and the opposition NASA coalition. NASA has been holding a daily protest demanding reforms at the IEBC ahead of the rescheduled presidential elections. Ruto says the Jubilee government is not against NASA's demands. Take a listen.
We have no minimum irreducible conditions. We have none. And we are not opposed to IEBC acceding to the demands by our competitors. Our position is that IEBC is an independent institution. They make their decisions independently of all the other arms of government and all the other competitors. But if they choose to have a discussion with our competitors with a view of firing this member of staff or firing that member of staff or changing this supplier or changing another supplier, we told them clearly we will not raise any issues. That is their business. If they so agree, they find a different printer, they find a different supplier of technology, as long as the elections are there, we will participate.
Now, DW's Catherine Omwando joins us from Nairobi. Catherine, is this a mere political statement, or does the vice president mean what he said?
Well, it's a complicated situation at this point, because in as much as the ruling party is saying that they will not interfere with the goings-on of the Electoral Commission, you have to remember that the ruling party has an electoral law up its sleeve. The law was passed through the lower house in parliament and also passed through the Senate, and now is waiting. Sorry, it was a bill. Now the bill is waiting to be assented to into law by the president, Uhuru Kenyatta. So in as much as the ruling party will say that they will not interfere with the Electoral Commission's work, you have to see it in a way that it's almost like a carrot and stick situation where they're holding the electoral bill as some sort of ransom in this particular situation. That's what most people would see it as.
There was a joint report on Monday by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch about the electoral violence and how 33 people were killed by police officers. Did the Vice President address that report?
He did, and he has come out very strongly in support of the police force. Even when confronted with the issue of the child, Baby Pendle, she was killed after the August 8th election that weekend, August 11th. By police. And even then, he says there's some calamities, but the police are there to ensure that the bad elements within protests are dealt with, and this is the best way to deal with. And he says that the police are also facing a lot of pressure. So he hasn't come out to deny the report, but he says he has come out in support of it, and he really kind of almost avoided the fact that 33 people, or at least 33 people, have been killed by police since August 8th. So, yeah, he was playing it cautious.
That was DW's Catherine Omwando reporting from Nairobi, Kenya. I see a couple of responses on our page as well, live on the Facebook page, right, Wanjiku?
Yes, Crispin Namagolwa, listening from Zambia. Thank you very much for joining us. We see everyone who's listening, and we appreciate that you are part of today's broadcast.
Thanks a lot for that.
Now to Middle East. Iraq's Interior Ministry says Kurdish forces have also withdrawn from other disputed territories in eastern Iraq, namely from three towns near the Iranian border. This is a day after Iraqi forces took back the disputed city of Kirkuk, forcing Kurdish fighters to leave. Sela Oneko has this report.
Thousands of civilians are streaming back into Kirkuk a day after they left, fearful of federal and Shiite militia rule as Iraqi forces pushed into the disputed city. Hassan Kader is one of the many returnees.
We don't know anything yet. We are about to enter, but we don't know if it's safe or not. Where else can I go, mister? I don't know where to go. It's better to go back. We are going back to our house and our city.
The Iraqi forces' retaking of Kirkuk came only 2 weeks after they had fought together with the Kurdish fighters to neutralize their common enemy, the so-called Islamic State group in Iraq. Major Qusay Chaloub al-Kinani from the Iraqi Counter-Terrorism Service explains.
All the families were kept yesterday and were terrified by the Peshmerga, who had told them that we were coming to destroy Kirkuk. They're all back, and they're all welcome. And everybody else can come back anytime. This is their city, and they're welcome.
Meanwhile, Kurdish forces lost more territory in Iraq on Tuesday, withdrawing from the town of Sinjar.
Sela Oneko with that report.
Now let's go to some of the responses on the page. Live on our Facebook page, DW Africa, I see Chimeka Biafra writing from Spain, says, good evening to you all. Nigerian government under Muhammad Buhari is violating international laws on human rights. Biafra exit via referendum. That's his response there.
And Lamin Kujabi is listening from Canada. Welcome. I also see Mo DZ Chelsea, an African listening from Germany. This is what he writes on the Facebook page. Remember, you too can join us on DW Africa and listen in. Ronald Emeka says hi.
And I promised earlier I would give a response to Carlo Gambino, who thinks Nnamdi Kanu will be convicted in an absentia. Well, we had two people, Enoch Dim and Ieka Oti, commenting on our phrasing. We wrote that Kanu's home was allegedly raided by soldiers. The Nigerian army still denies that they raided the house in September. Kanu supporters and his family have said that their soldiers invaded the house and killed about 28 people. Keep it Africa Link. Welcome back. You are listening to Africa Link with me, Abubakar Jallo.
And Wanji Komora, thanks for joining us live on our Facebook page, DW Africa.
Coming up in this half of Africa Link, Ethiopia's female superheroes are working nonstop for the future generation.
Obviously, I couldn't build kindergarten everywhere. So I start thinking, how can I reach millions of children in my country with less cost, but with quality education?
And remember, we are monitoring your responses live on Facebook.
Definitely bring them whenever we can. But before that, our series, which began yesterday on why there is still hunger in Africa. About half of all South Sudanese depend on food aid. This is not only due to the persistent drought in the country, but also to the bloody power struggles. Women in particular suffer from the vicious circle of hunger and violence. Our correspondents Adrian Krish and Jan Philip Schultz travel to Bentiu in the far north of the country and meet aid agents and people affected by the severe food shortage. Their report is now presented by Crispin Mwakide.
It is time for the monthly food distribution in the Bentiu refugee camp. Thousands of people stand in perfect queues waiting to receive food rations. The United Nations had set up this camp to protect civilians shortly after the outbreak of South Sudan's civil war in 2013. Today, the camp hosts almost 200,000 displaced people. Due to the armed conflict, a hunger crisis has developed over the years, which has engulfed almost the entire country. Hannah Nyerure patiently waits for food along with other women. The mother of four has repeatedly tried to go without food aid. She even moved back to her village with her children.
The security situation is not good, but at home in the village I can at least try to grow crops and vegetables.
Nevertheless, she has to do the five-hour walk to the food distribution center in the camp every month. The last rainy season was unusually short, and Hannah Nyerure could hardly grow anything. What is even worse than the lack of rain is the ongoing fighting. When something grows on her fields, hungry government soldiers or rebels take everything away violently. Even the aid supplies from the camp are most often robbed away by the armed men.
It's definitely not safe to walk long distances with the food, but we have no choice. The fighters usually do not take the whole ration.
Thomas Hughes knows the dangers for women like Nyerure very well. He coordinates the food supply in Bentiu for the German organization Welthungerhilfe.
If we could open up more distribution centers, it would be good for the people, especially for women. But the security risk for us and our staff are growing. The smaller and more remote the settlement is, the more difficult it is to protect our own people.
South Sudanese journalist Parak Mak has reported extensively about the conflict, which began as a political power struggle between President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar. It then developed into a horrific fighting along ethnic lines. Many of the crimes committed by armed groups now have to do with the fact that the fighters are also often hungry, the journalist explains.
They don't have salary, they're not paid, and well, what they get in war is what actually they take. So killing or raping, it has nothing to do with not being paid, but it has something to do with the breakdown of social fabric, that you're not able to differentiate between an innocent civilian and an armed soldier.
For relief agent Thomas Hughes, South Sudanese lack better perspectives. If young people had alternatives to fighting, the bloody conflict and the hunger crisis could finally come to an end.
Unfortunately, we are completely failing to offer the people in the camps an option of vocational training. And men without perspectives face serious threats everywhere. Once they have had that experience in the militia, they see it as the only alternative in their head.
And that report was compiled by Adrian Krish and Jan Philip Scholz.
And the world marked World Food Day yesterday. And on Africa Link, we are running a series of asking the question, why are African countries struggling with hunger?
That is definitely a big question. And we are looking into the political causes and as well as the social causes as well of hunger in Africa.
And we've been receiving your comments as well on this particular issue. Alhaji Chasa Bubakar says, 3 years ago, my mother, she was a great farmer of maize and rice in our community. But now we don't even have 50 kilograms of food. We've run and left our country to Niger. I'm asking the Nigerian government to help us so that we can return to our town.
And Julian Scotty says, we have fertile land in Africa to feed all of the world. Your station can start a micro giant grant for interested young African farmers. Well, Julian, that will of course be a great idea, but I'm sure there are people that are more able to do this than us.
And we'll be there to report about it.
Africa on the move.
A new children's TV show featuring three superheroines is helping young Ethiopian girls challenge social barriers. The animation series Tibeb Girls is putting the spotlight on the lives of Ethiopian women and girls. In the series, whenever a girl is in trouble, three ordinary Ethiopian girls transform into hooded, flying superheroes with magical powers. But what inspired the producer of this series? Eunice Wanjiro presents this report by Efa Bayer.
The first episode of Tibeb Girls is being shown at a school in Addis Ababa. Tibeb means wisdom in Amharic. In the series, three clever superheroines fight for the equality of girls and women. The creative head behind the program is Brooke Tawit Tigabu.
One out of five girls in Ethiopia married before age 15, and most of them will never go back to school. That means they are robbed from their opportunity to succeed in life.
Tigabu's animation, Tibeb Girls, wants to change this. It is therefore important to the program's creators that the children can identify with the series. So they organize regular screenings at local schools to see whether the pilot episode is well received. Ruth Yitbarek is also one of the organizers.
We're doing this like in different parts of Ethiopia also. So there we have seen so many girls crying because they know what she's been through. So that is something close to their heart, something they know, so they can connect with that.
After the film, the children write down what they liked or what they didn't like, as well as which storylines they would like to see continued. Edlawit shares her experience.
I thought the movie was great because it was about issues that concern us girls. I've never seen anything like it before.
The Tibeb Girls series is the brainchild of Brooke Tawit Tigabu. The trained nurse says she simply could not ignore the plight facing young women in Ethiopia.
So I said, how can I solve this huge problem? Obviously, I couldn't build kindergarten everywhere. So I start thinking, how can I reach millions of children in my country with less cost, but with quality education?
Tigabu has already produced three successful radio and television series. Every week, the programs educate millions of children around the country, but in a fun way. Hopefully, Tibeb Girls will become another success story and help challenge social taboos. Distributing the programs is difficult and resources are scarce. Tigabu says that the idea of social entrepreneurship has not yet established itself in Ethiopia.
The policies don't support us because we're still looked at as a business person. So we've been taxed the same way. What that means is we're frugal. We're frugal innovators. We have small resources. We have to do a lot.
But the Tibeb Girls have a strong, motivated team behind them and will not give up in the face of these obstacles. Negotiations with TV broadcasters are still ongoing.
Efa Bayer with that report from Ethiopia.
Focus Europe.
And from Ethiopia, we take you now to Europe. In recent weeks, we've brought you scenes from the streets of Barcelona, where separatists are pushing for independence from Spain. There have been pro- and anti-independence rallies. Some Catalans voted in a disputed referendum on October the 1st. In a speech this past week, the Catalan president declared independence but then suspended it, calling for dialogue. Now we take you to Madrid to hear other Spaniards outside Catalonia to see their views as well. Loya Freya reports.
When she saw TV reports about some of her countrymen rallying for independence, 84-year-old María Feijó Grande went out and bought a Spanish flag and draped it over her balcony in Madrid. Several of her neighbors have done the same, and María's barrio is suddenly a sea of red and yellow Spanish flags, even more than when Spain won the World Cup. This time, it's a show of unity against part of the country, Catalonia, breaking away.
Está fuera de la ley.
They're breaking the law. We all voted and ratified the Spanish Constitution in 1978. They can't just change their minds now.
Catalonia did approve the Spanish Constitution a generation ago, but now the region is ruled by separatists who defied court rulings and held a banned independence referendum October 1st. 90% voted for secession, but turnout was low. Don't fool us. Catalonia is part of Spain. Tens of thousands of people chanted in Madrid.
Golpista, I don't know.
Okay. Protesters Ana García and her husband Juan Manuel Duran accuse Catalan leaders of staging a coup and want them arrested. As police units from all over Spain are redeployed to Catalonia to maintain order there, there have been send-off parades, where townspeople yell, A por ellos, like, go get them, as if they're going off to war. Emilio Silva is the president of Spain's Association for Historical Memory, a group that exhumes mass graves from the Spanish Civil War and dictatorship that followed. The war pitted neighbors against each other, and those feelings are still raw 80 years on. Any challenge to Spain's unity, especially from within, inspires a fierce backlash, he says.
On his deathbed in 1975, the dictator Francisco Franco had one last order: keep Spain united. This is like an obsession. It's made some people suspicious of devolving powers to Spain's autonomous regions.
Just when you thought there was little middle ground here, a small, if noisy, demonstration broke out, where people waved white flags and unfurled a banner that said, Hablamos, let's talk. Marco Álvarez is a madrileño in that crowd. He wants the Spanish government to explain why it wants Catalans to stay united with Spain, to counter the independence movement with reason, not with more nationalism.
I think the referendum should have been legal, but campaigned heavily for the no. But the way they handled it has led to this violence, to this confrontation. And now we've never been so tense.
And the tension appears only to be growing.
Lauren Freya reporting.
And we are still receiving your comments. Coach Ambrose listening from Nairobi. How is the weather like in Nairobi? Tell us. And we have still so many people joining us. Thank you so much.
Amado Dilera says, I hear you, DW.
And we hear you too.
Interesting one. Anyways, in response to our food and hunger situation in across Africa, we have a response from Tuji Amani, who says the problem of food shortages in parts of Africa is due to poor leadership, bad policies, lack of peace, and insufficient security.
And the argument from Ghana says we don't lack food, but the cost is high. And he's highlighting the economic factors that would prevent some people to access food.
Interesting. I have a question for you, Wanjiko.
Yes.
What is the statue of President Jacob Zuma doing in Nigeria?
Well, he's being... I cannot justify this.
Anyway, Nigerians are furious about this story that they've unveiled a statue of President Jacob Zuma, President of South Africa, in Nigeria. Comments here from Isaac. Who's that Godwin?
Yes, and he says, why does Nigeria do nothing about this after the way South Africa treated Nigerians living in South Africa?
And the final one here from Kabengele Guy from South Africa, right? How come the Nigerian state can honor South African President Jacob Zuma with a statue, but its citizens here are the subject of crime? Anyways, that's the question we are all asking. Thank you so much for joining us. We will be back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Abubakar Jallo.
With me, Wenji Komora.
Bye now.